This is an AMI podcast.
Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. It's Thursday, March the 30th, 2023. Coming up in the second hour of the show, are technology trends moving so fast that users can't actually enjoy them? Stephen Scott from Double Tap will contemplate this question. And Don Dickinson previews Voices of the Walrus with an article about the new slasher flick, Winnie the Pooh and Honey. Winnie the Pooh being turned into a horror film. The beauty of public domain. Brock Richardson will be here in a moment with the sports chat, but the hour begins with the regional news updates. The BC Wildfire Service says crews helped knock down a 7-hectare blaze yesterday near Merritt. It was the latest of nearly two dozens fires sparked so far this month in the southern interior. Fire Information Officer Taylor Wallace says conditions are quite dry. Crews are conducting prescribed burns in the region's forests. Over to the prairies, a public health advocacy group is expressing concern about the Saskatchewan government's plan to spend $6 million to send patients to Calgary for hip and knee surgeries. Chris Galloway with Friends of Medicare says the province should spend more money on publicly delivered surgeries.
It's part of this bigger privatization picture and agenda that's very concerning, that we're undermining our ability to actually do surgeries. And we're really prioritizing profit. And we're also now creating competition for access to these centers.
The province says the short-term plan will reduce wait times by providing surgeries sooner. Over to Ontario, Toronto's city council is asking for more money from the federal and provincial government. The city is dealing with a nearly $1 billion shortfall to its budget. Deputy Mayor Jennifer McKelvey says residents can expect service cuts without a bailout.
So you're going to see those cuts rapidly happen in 2024 if we don't get assistance. We are able to use the reserves we've squirreled away to pay for this year. But it's not a good strategy going forward.
And over to the Atlantic provinces, the public inquiry into the 2020 Nova Scotia mass shooting will release its final report today. Keith Doucette looks ahead.
A three-person commission is expected to release a voluminous report following 7 months of public hearings. The tragic events began on April 18, 2020, in the rural coastal community of Portapique, when a 51-year-old Halifax denturist assaulted his spouse, loaded his illegal firearms into a replica RCMP vehicle, and began shooting his neighbors. The gunman murdered 22 people over a 13-hour span before being shot by police at a gas station outside Halifax. Keith Doucette, The Canadian Press.
That's your look at the regional news. Let's bring in Brock Richardson for a sports chat. Oh, Brock, it's one of the best days on the sports calendar. I feel like I say that to you a lot, but it's one of the best days on the sports calendar. It's Major League Baseball's opening day from 1 p.m. Eastern time till about 1 a.m. Eastern time. There's going to be oh so much baseball to consume. Brock, how excited are you?
I am very, very, very excited. I love baseball. I wouldn't say that it's my favorite sport, but it is right up there, and I love it. It goes through the summer. Sometimes in, you know, August, September, it becomes, oh, this is on too long. Let's get to the playoffs. But overall, I love it.
Yeah, same here. It's something that so deeply connects to my childhood, going to so many games at the Olympic Stadium to watch the Montreal Expos play, where tickets were $3, $4, $5. There was like a dollar hot dog night almost every night. I spent a lot of my teenage years going to Expos games and loving that team and loving baseball. And even with the introduction of some of these new rules, the pitch clock and the bigger bases, things to try and improve the pace of play, there's something that's still so timeless about baseball and relaxing about baseball. That's going to feel a little bit different this year with the games moving a little bit faster. But frankly, the games were averaging over 3 hours last year. Let's get that down to be a little bit more manageable. So I'm excited, Brock. It's a pretty busy day on the television broadcast side. I've been having trouble figuring out how TSN's approaching the day, Brock, but I can tell you for certain that we're going to get the Giants and the Yankees at 1 o'clock Eastern time, and then the Blue Jays and the Cardinals around 4 o'clock Eastern time on Sportsnet. But Brock, before we dive deeper into the Blue Jays expectation, generally speaking, what's on your brain? What are you anticipating in regards to this season?
The first thing that I like about this season is the balanced schedule. I think the balanced schedule is going to make it so much easier for all teams across the league. What I mean by that is you're not spending as much time in your own division playing your own team. And I know that there are some divisions that are harder than others in baseball. And so it's interesting to see what does that translate to in relation to playoff races when we get to talk about July, August, September. Well, how does the balanced schedule translate into that? I am looking forward for the pitch clock. I did see there was some umpires that decided to insert themselves in a spring training game, which we won't get into, but we'll see how all of this gets managed. And for me, that's what I'm looking forward to. But the first one on my list is the balanced schedule.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a couple of really good teams with significant expectations going into the year, Brock, because there are some real powerhouses in the National League. During the course of the offseason, the New York Mets spent nearly $1 billion acquiring players to bolster their roster. The Philadelphia Phillies, who went to the World Series last year, spent a whole bunch of money bringing in shortstop Trey Turner from the LA Dodgers to join their squad. And Trey Turner, this is a player that could win the MVP this year because he hits the ball for amazing contact. He's got a lot of power. He's got the potential to hit 30, 40, 50 home runs, but he's also a speed player. So with the bigger bases and some of the different rules about holding runners on base this year, he has the possibility to steal 30, 40, 50 bases. So if he hits 50 home runs and steals 50 bases and the Philadelphia Phillies are good, he's got a real strong shot at winning the National League MVP. But I'm looking at this National League, Brock. I'm looking at that NL East where the Atlanta Braves bolster the best pitching staff in baseball. You look at the Mets, who spent $1 billion on their players, and you look at the Philadelphia Phillies coming back off a World Series run. Yes, they have a couple injuries to deal with earlier in the season, but overall, that division is going to be strong, strong, strong. You then go to the West, where the LA Dodgers continue to be a powerhouse via good drafting and developing and lots of free agent signings, but you also get the San Diego Padres, who continue to just load up on talent. The acquisition of Juan Soto last season, one of the best young hitters in the game. Manny Machado got a contract extension in the offseason. He continues to be one of the most dominant hitters in the game. Fernando Tatis Jr. will be coming back after a steroid suspension early in the season. That is something to look out for, not to mention the signing of the shortstop from Boston, Xander Bogaerts, who's just a really efficient clutch hitter. Brock, a lot of the power this year, a lot of the balance of power is going to sit in the National League, and I am so excited to see how that shakes out both early in the season and as we move towards the playoff run.
Yeah, I am looking forward to the San Diego Padres too. And again, I'm going to vow here at day one of this that we are going to talk about, you know, all across, because yes, Blue Jays is our national team and that's where we should focus. But there are some other good stories. I love the Rob Thompson angle still. I mean, he's Canadian. He's got a good team. We'll see how all that goes.
That's the manager of the Phillies, just in case anybody is cluing in on that one.
Yeah. So sorry, I should have been a little more clear on that. But yeah, there's all kinds of stories in the National League that just, you know, is good. And yes, there's a lot in the American League as well, but it's going to be good times this year as we move through the season.
Okay. I Brock, I'm in on that pledge with you. Let's make sure we're covering lots of baseball rather than just the Blue Jays. But we'd be remiss if we didn't at least talk a little bit about the Toronto Blue Jays, who opened their season today in St. Louis. Brock, you heard Kevin Kiermaier, the outfielder acquired in the offseason earlier this week, saying this team has the potential to win 100 games. Where are you putting that over-under for the Jays this year?
We have seen what happens to Blue Jays who make public declarations of trailers, movies, 100 wins. I love the optimism. I do. I still look at the American League East and I say, 100 wins, I will see. I would like to see them in and around the 93, 94, 95 win. If they could get into that 100, I would be thrilled. I think that's going to contend for the American League East championship. But again, I'm not necessarily jumping all in like Kiermaier is. I think that if we can get into that 95 win range, I think I'd be pretty happy with this team.
Yeah, I would say that certainly it's a playoff expectation. Winning the division is going to be tough. Wrestling this away from the New York Yankees, who didn't necessarily make the free agent splashes this offseason, but they have called up their top prospect who's going to start his season with the big club. Anthony Volpe is probably going to be playing third base pretty frequently for the Yankees. You still have great hitters like DJ LeMahieu. You still have that outfield with Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. There's just so much talent and power on that Yankees team that even though the Blue Jays have done a really nice job of improving in the margins, I don't know, Brock, that they're ready to take that step over the Yankees in a division that, by the way, it continues to get better with Baltimore on the rise. I don't think Boston will be as poor as they were last year. Tampa may take a little bit of a step back. A lot of these rule changes might actually directly impact Tampa the most, as that was a team that loved to use the shift and loved to use a lot of analytics principles in the way they played baseball. But just considering the nature of the division, Brock, the Blue Jays certainly aiming for 100 is what they should do, but they should be ready for another battle for a wild card spot.
They should. And let's also, and I know this is the really obvious angle to take, but it is the truth of it all. The truth of it all, injuries is going to play a big part in all this. And It always does in Major League Baseball, but it seems to be more highlighted in the American League East because all those teams are so good. And as you mentioned, most of them are going to be better than last. And so if the Toronto Blue Jays can avoid injury for the long term, yes, I think this is doable. But over 162 games, you're going to expect 1, 2, 3, you know, relative major injuries over a season. Hopefully it doesn't keep people out for a long, long time. But that's just the product of playing so many games over such a long stretch.
I do see where maybe there's some potential this year, especially with a player like Jose Barrios, for example, right? The starting pitcher who was brought in with quite a bit of expectation at the trade deadline about a year and a half ago and had a really rough year last year. I do wonder if maybe there's a bounce back season for Barrios that's going to fill some of these gaps on that starting rotation that made it such a big question mark last year. Anytime you're talking about a pitching staff staying healthy, though, it can get a little complicated. I certainly would love to see Alec Manoah, the ace of the staff, the player who's going to be starting for the team today, the opening starter. I would love to see him as a young player take a step forward, but I also thought he pitched so well last year. There's the possibility of regression, right? Baseball's a weird sport. You can get these positive regressions or progressions where maybe Barrios bounces back a little bit, but what's the risk that Manoah ends up taking a step backwards?
And to that effect, you're also got to be looking at someone like Yusei Kikuchi. You know, we keep hearing, oh, he's under one in ERA. Yeah, give it to me when it matters. If you can get even a half of the starts that he didn't give us last year, that's going to make a big difference as well. The depth on pitching beyond the 5-6 starting rotation is a bit scary, and so we can't sustain big injuries and we can't sustain people not holding their end of the bargain. So to me, pitching is the biggest.
Yeah.
What are we going to do? There's no question the offense is going to be there. But can we hold off the 5-6 runs per game that we need to? Can the pitching, especially at the last, you know, two pitchers of the spots, can they hold off some wins that we need? And I'm not so sold on Yusei Kikuchi as some others. Jose Barrios, I'm a little bit more patient with. I think some people have said, well, we've spent a lot of money on him, so put up or shut up, basically,
yeah,
which I agree with, but I do think we're going to see a turnaround. Yusei Kikuchi, I'm not so much sold on.
Yeah, don't forget about Kevin Gausman as well, who was also brought in the previous offseason, who was lights out to start the year last year and really stumbled down the finish line. So I also wonder what Gausman might be this year. I did see a couple analysts predicting he might be a dark horse Cy Young candidate in the American League. I wondered if maybe that was some Blue Jays tinted glasses that was going on there. But certainly the way that he throws the ball, those beautiful breaking balls, those great curveballs, it'll be fun to see. Hey, Brock, before we say goodbye, any last thoughts you want to say about MLB opening day?
The Blue Jays have a way of having their own tinted glasses because we're the only national team. And so we forget about, you know, other teams in the league. No, I think it's going to be a good year. I look forward to seeing what the catchers can produce, you know, with these bigger bases and more stolen bases. The catchers are going to have to be more on point as a league all around, because people are going to try to steal bases. And if you don't have a good catcher back there who can throw, you might be in trouble.
Yeah, I'm also curious to see if Alejandro Kirk can continue the offensive explosion that he had last year at catcher. You think about all these young players for the Blue Jays, you don't realize that Alejandro Kirk is only 25 years old. He's part of that young core. He was tearing the cover off the ball last year. Don't know that he'll be the everyday catcher this year. Danny Jansen's going to get lots of opportunities behind the plate as well, especially because of his defensive prowess. But you're right, the catchers could be a big, big part of the question this year. Hey, Brock, you enjoy yourself some opening day. Enjoy some peanuts and Cracker Jacks, and I know when you'll be back. It's tomorrow morning. Have a great day, buddy.
I will. You as well.
That's Brock Richardson. He's at the AMI Sports Desk MLB opening day. There's going to be games on Sportsnet all afternoon and evening long, and there is going to be some games. This is Now with Dave Brown. Let's go over to Alex Smythe at the AMI Weather Desk.
Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. In Corner Brook, Newfoundland, today it's a mix of sun and clouds with snow starting in the afternoon. The high is +5, wind chill -9. In Charlottetown, PEI, it's a mix of sun and clouds with rain starting this afternoon, and the high is 5 degrees. To St. John, New Brunswick, where it's a mix of sun and clouds with snow or rain this afternoon, they're calling for up to 4 centimeters of snow set to fall. There's also wind gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour. The high is +3, the wind chill -9. In Quebec City, Quebec, it snowed this morning, then it's going to be cloudy in the afternoon. There are wind gusts up to 60 kilometers per hour. The high -3, the wind chill -21 this morning. In Toronto, Ontario, it's clear, becoming a mix of sun and cloud later in the morning. The high is +6, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like -11. Over to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, it is mainly sunny today. The high is +2, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like -18. In Brandon, Manitoba, it's sunny with a mix of sun and cloud this morning. The high is -2, the wind chill -25. In Regina, Saskatchewan, it's a mix of sun and clouds, a high of -2 as well, but the wind chill is slightly warmer at only -23 this morning. The Lethbridge, Alberta, where it's cloudy with a chance of snow and up to 2 centimeters set to fall in some areas. The high is +2, the wind chill -9. In Red Deer, Alberta today, it's a mix of sun and clouds clearing up late in the afternoon. The high is +3 with a wind chill of -13. As we head up to Whitehorse, Yukon, it's cloudy with a chance of snow today. The high is 0 degrees, but there is a wind chill that makes it feel like -13. But now, as we move into BC, it's a gorgeous day throughout the province. In Kelowna, it is a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 13 degrees today. And then finally in Vancouver, BC, it is mainly sunny, also a high of 13 degrees. And that's your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Alex. Coming up after the break, the question will be contemplated. Is technology evolving and developing so fast that you can't actually enjoy it in the moment? Stephen Scott of Double Tap will explore that question with me. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Ooh. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Technology is perpetually evolving. There's always a new smartphone or a new computer or new AI software or new LiDAR or new cameras or new video game systems. New. Newer is always better. Or is it? How does that perpetual speedy development of technology and tech trends impacting our ability to actually stop and smell and enjoy the pixels in real time? Stephen Scott is the host of Double Tap, which you can find daily on AMI Audio at noon. Hey, good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Dave. How are you today?
Stephen, I am well. I like it when we can get a little philosophical in the way we talk about technology, because I would say technology is moving quite quickly. Maybe your perspective is a little bit different, though, as somebody who hosts a daily technology news talk show.
Yeah, please don't slow it down too much, because, you know, I kind of need things to talk about. So, you know, let's not slow it down too much. But, you know, it's interesting the way you frame this, because there's a strange paradox going on at the moment. On one hand, you're absolutely right. There feels like an endless array of new technology coming out. You know, if you're not into the tech world, as a lot of people aren't, maybe they use technology, but they're not necessarily into it. They're not geeking out about it. You might be forgiven for thinking that every time you hear about a new iPhone, for example, that as soon as you hear about the new one, you're hearing about the next new one, and then the next new one after that. And you're maybe holding your iPhone, looking at, you know, the cracked screen, perhaps, and, you know, the scratch on the back, and thinking, well, there's nothing wrong with this thing, really. It still works. I've had it for 3-4 years, maybe even longer, and it works fine. It's getting all the updates. So why do I need to change? Whilst at the same time, we have all this movement in artificial intelligence, which is really thundering up the track and has done so in a very, very short space of time. The actual work around AI, artificial intelligence, has been going on for years, but we as consumers are starting to see it. And what we're seeing is really, on one side of this, technology is evolution. It's continuing all the time, but at the same token, not changing very much. Whilst on the other side, you have this thing thundering through that's changing everything all at once. So it's an interesting paradox at the moment.
You mentioned artificial intelligence. So certainly in the last 12 months or so, there's been the explosion of DALL-E, which is an AI image generator. There was ChatGPT. And then even within a few months of that getting a lot of buzz, OpenAI came out with another newer version of ChatGPT. Stephen, when we're talking about that rapid evolution, when things are changing so fast, are people not actually getting to enjoy the technology? So, for example, ChatGPT, unless you were early on to trying out the software, the waiting list made it almost impossible to get into ChatGPT. And now we get the new one out before people even got to try the old one. Are we at a point where maybe people are not getting to feel the tangible joy of a technological development because of how fast we just move on to the next thing?
I think in technology terms, you have to be very careful here, because there's the reality of what's going on in the tech world, and there's some amazing movements going on to really revolutionize our world, truly revolutionize it. And that can be quite scary as well for people's jobs. We're hearing that a lot. In practical terms, what will happen to the likes of accountants, of people who are content creators, people who work in finance, people who work in all kinds of industries, even teaching professions are concerned about this. You know, the way that pupils are able to utilize this. I mean, kids are obviously going to jump on this. They're using it to cheat on their homework at the moment. You know, these are real concerns people have. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of people out there who don't have a clue how this even works. Even me, I mean, I sit here and I talk about this stuff, but I still try to think about a tangible reason for a regular person to use this at the moment. It's still very early days. And, you know, again, we're at this very early stage, but at the same time, it feels like it's moving very, very quickly. Should we take time to stop and reflect? Well, that question comes out of a very interesting letter, which was sent by a number of signatories from an organization called the Future Institute, which really is highlighting the idea that ultimately we're moving too fast. Now, I have to say, there's a little bit of concern here about the people who are signing this.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit less an agenda involved here. We're talking about people like Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. We're talking about Elon Musk. And anytime Elon Musk's name is mentioned, I feel like somewhere there's flashing lights going off and, you know, a horn beeping somewhere, because someone's thinking, hang on, what is going on here? Why is he involved in this? But ultimately, and we should also say, just to be very clear on this, you know, Elon Musk once had a stake in OpenAI, the company that's now thundering ahead with all this artificial intelligence revolution. He's now no longer part of that. And it's interesting, he's now at the forefront of a campaign to slow things down.
Yeah.
So what's his agenda here? So I think there's that question.
I do want to pick up on that, but yeah, to my point, though.
Well, to your point specifically, though, about all of us and how we feel about this, yes, I think we don't have the chance. We don't have the opportunity to really fully grasp what this technology can do. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. And the main one is that we don't really have the tools anymore to very easily learn. I feel that this is where shows like ours come in. The discussions like this are important because we need to bring people along who just don't understand how this stuff works or how it can benefit them, so that when the revolution comes, we actually know what we're facing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so to the letter you were mentioning there about those 500 signatories saying we need to take a pause on all AI development or new AI development until we figure out the safety and security of this all, I haven't looked at all 500 signatories, but Stephen, if I was to be cynical, I would probably tell you these are 500 people who just got blown out of the water on AI research and are like, we need 6 months to catch up.
That's pretty much, that's my thinking as well. I will also warn you, there are a lot of fake names on that signatory list. Apparently, the OpenAI CEO, Sam Altman's on there. I don't think he would have signed that. I'm just guessing, but I don't think he's the kind of guy to sign it. So you just have to be a little bit careful about some of the names on that signatory list.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, clearly this is a drive to slow things down, either to allow others to catch up. I mean, for example, Google are still very behind on all this. Apple are nowhere to be seen on this one at the moment.
Yeah.
So the big tech, even Amazon. I mean, Amazon are really struggling at the moment, it seems, because they are letting go so many people. And there's concerns around the future of Lady A and what that is going to mean and how this can even be built in. So, you know, there's a lot of tech companies way behind, and it does feel like perhaps they need the time to catch up to Microsoft. But because they've put the investment in and because they've got behind OpenAI, they are thundering ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, I was doing, in preparation for this segment yesterday, a little bit of a archiving of the technology around my house, an inventory of the technology around my house. And as I've told you before, I tend to be a late adopter on a lot of things. So let me talk about a couple of the pieces of technology that I have, because I'm someone who probably does enjoy the technology that I have because I'm a late adopter on things. So my work phone was given to me in 2019. My personal phone I bought in 2021. My two computers at home were bought in 2019. My Xbox was bought in 2019. My TV was bought in 2021. So in my case, Stephen, I tend to enjoy all these things because I keep them for a long time. What are some of the devices that you find yourself hanging on to, and why do you hang on to them?
Well, I must admit, when it comes to televisions and things, I tend to stick with the same TV for years. I think it's a visual thing, if I'm honest. I don't really care too much about the picture. So until there isn't a picture, I don't really worry about it.
Yeah.
If it gets to the point where the picture just goes completely, then okay, fine. Even then, I could just live with the audio, to be perfectly honest. But when it comes to my smartphones, you would think I'm one of these people who would update every year. And I will say I do. I don't use the latest every year, though. I tend to either have it for a short period of time to test it and then send it back, or I hold on to the old. And I'm using right now an iPhone 13 mini because I love the iPhone 13 mini size, and they've never created a mini since. So, you know, arguably there isn't a mini, but there is, because you can buy the old one, which is not old. Again, this is the point. This is not old tech. This is good technology. So I've got the iPhone 13 mini. Of course, the iPhone 15 is due out this year. So we'll see what that comes with. But, you know, ultimately, I don't really need it. In terms of laptops, it's funny, right, because with PC laptops in particular, you don't really have this with Apple so much, because there is a shelf life with Apple products. But, and I will say, you know, the shelf life is about 10, 12 years. So it's a long time. But with a PC laptop, I could pick up a laptop from 20 years ago near enough, and it would probably still run Windows 10 at least. So, you know, you can get a lot more out of older tech, and I find some of the older laptops better. I think the keyboards are better. They're less focused on how they look and how stylish they are, and actually more focused on, you know, productivity. And so I find some of the older Lenovo business-style laptops more my kind of thing, because they just get the job done. Mm-hmm. They run the latest software and they work. So why get rid of them? And that's the point, you know. So there's a lot of great new tech out there, but I think sometimes we can also look in that renewed or second-hand or pre-loved or whatever phrase you want to use when you're buying. Because, you know, I say this a lot in my show. If you're buying a new smartphone, you don't have to spend the money on a brand new one. You know, Amazon, for example, have got the Renewed. If you're blind or partially sighted, you've got the CNIB Phone It Forward campaign. So, of course, you've got the ability to get hold of a phone if you can't afford one. You know, there's lots of options out there for people. So you don't have to spend a fortune to get the latest and greatest. You know, as I say, if you were to go back to the iPhone 10, even back to the iPhone 8, it is a good device and many people still loving it today.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
you don't need to buy the latest.
Stephen, I like that. I like that as a concluding thought. Have yourself a wonderful day. Always fun to catch up with you. I know you don't watch baseball, but enjoy opening day.
I have no idea what it is, but I'm sure it's wonderful. And I'm sure you'll love it. Have a great time, Dave.
Thanks, Stephen. That's Stephen Scott, one of the hosts of Double Tap, which you can find weekdays at noon Eastern time on AMI Audio. And you can find Double Tap on Twitter at Double Tap on Air. You can find The Pulse on AMI Audio Thursdays at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Today, Joita Gupta will speak with author Elizabeth Emmons about her book, Life Admin, How I Learned to Do Less, Do Better, and Live More. Sounds good to me. That's The Pulse, Thursdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern time on AMI Audio. Coming up next, Alex Smyth is thinking about comedy and how it ages and wants to ask which modern film should be considered a classic. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Alex Smyth watched a comedy classic last night and is considering what could make for a modern movie classic. Hey, Alex, what's on your mind?
Hey, yeah, Dave. So I watched the movie Airplane last night with Leslie Nielsen, one of my favorite comedy movies of all time. And, you know, for the most part, the film still holds up in my mind. Obviously, there's some jokes that are not only dated, some are inappropriate nowadays, but could never be made. Some, the references are completely lost just because they were very timely. But there's other jokes in it that still remain eternal and just continue to kind of hit and land with the same comedy that it did when it first was released. So it got me thinking, it's like, okay, well, you know, that's considered a classic. What film that's come out recently would you put into that same kind of category, or would you think will stand up the test of time and become a classic movie? So I really wanted to open it up to the round table and find out what everyone was thinking. So Ramya, why don't we start with you? What movie do you think that's come out in like the last 5 years will become immortalized as a classic film going forward?
So I'm not sure if this came out in the last 5 years, but definitely in the last decade, and it's one of my favorites, and it's 40-Year-Old Virgin with Steve Carell.
Ramya, I've got bad news for you. That movie's almost like 20 years old.
No way! Okay, well, pretend it's new, because I will tell you why. Like, my reasoning for this type of movie, and I guess you can like count Hangover and other movies like this in this category, because it's the physical humor. So anything that is, you know, cultural-based or has humor where it's really a snapshot of time can kind of become controversial. People sitting on both sides of the fence, whether it's funny or not, or whether it's going to stand the test of time, like the question of the day. But physical humor, you know, Steve Carell is like one of the guys who I think is just hysterical with this stuff. Jim Carrey's another one. And I think that, like, they're, you know, not just the content, but their character is what makes it funny. And I think stuff like that is, it brings people more together than the controversy of, is this comical? Is this considered good comedy?
Steve Carell getting his chest waxed in that movie will never not be funny. Like, will never not be funny. And I can say that as a hairy man. I can laugh at that every single time. Nazreen, what about you? A modern movie that you think could become a classic?
The first thing I thought of was Black Panther, which came out 5 years ago. And wow, when I say 5 years ago, it just feels like a long time.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, and Wakanda. So I think that really did make history, and it will continue to make history today.
So Nazreen picked an action movie or a superhero movie. Ramya picked a comedy movie. I would go with more of a dramatic film. I suppose it's in a superhero universe. But to me, what makes a movie a classic is it needs to say something. It has to have a point of view. And that's why I would argue the 2019 movie Joker is a movie that should be considered a modern classic because it had a lot to say about mental health. It had a lot to say about socioeconomic class. It had a lot to say about urban decay. It was a brilliant, brilliant movie that will continue to stand the test of time in what it had to say. And I'll put that in context for you. What are some classics that come to mind when you think about older movies? The Godfather. That was a movie that was all about family and the importance of family and the decay of the family unit. If you think about war movies like Apocalypse Now, that had something to say about the horrors of war and the toll it took on people. In that line of thinking as well, Taxi Driver, starring Robert De Niro, was a movie about the Vietnam War and what depression was doing to Robert De Niro and the way the society turned its back on Travis Bickle. There was a movie needs to say something and be about something to be a classic. Alex, you posed the question, but what modern movie do you think could be a classic?
Well, one that first came to mind for me is the one that's been on top of mind for everyone recently, and that's Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I think the reason why I think that's going to become a classic, it was so unique in terms of its kind of story, its idea. Like, it was such a fresh take over the span of kind of the last couple of years, where we really haven't seen a lot of original new content ideas that really kind of came out and had such an impact just across the spectrum of viewers. Like, you know, it's won Best Picture this year, but beyond that, like, if you think back, like, the past 5 years Best Picture winners, you know, I don't think, even if you can remember them all, I don't think people are really going to be like, oh, that's a classic film, I'm going to go back. I think this is one, it has a bit of everything. It has comedy, it has drama, it has action. There's the serious note, the light note, the absurd notes of it. There's cultural references. There are all sorts of things just tied into one that I think people are just going to go back and rewatch over and over again, because there's going to be something to latch on to for everyone going forward.
All right. Everybody picked a different genre in the way we picked a modern classic. I'm curious from all of you, we've got to be a little quick here on this, so I want to make sure we give Dawn Dickinson her time in the next segment, but how does genre influence the possibility of a film being a classic? Because I would argue that comedy is a risky game, that even things in The 40-Year-Old Virgin have aged a little bit poorly. Even a movie like Superbad, which was pretty ahead of the game for that high school style graduation movie, had a fairly progressive view on sexual misconduct and rape culture, but it's still like was very much present within the film. So I would say even comedy classics can age a little bit poorly. So I'd say comedy is something that has trouble being a true classic, that generations will sort of take away the funniness. So Alex, starting with you, how does genre end up impacting the possibility of something being a classic?
Yeah, you know, it does play a role. I think comedies are probably up against it the most when it comes to having that staying power because of how we view comedy on through a modern lens and how we reflect on comedy in the past. I agree. Like, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin, even Airplane, like there's jokes in there that you could not tell today, but, you know, so people will have a differing or evolving view on what is funny about a film, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. I think that also can be said about action, is the level of violence, the gory factor, just the raw amount of just gun violence and things like that, that can come into a conversation. So I think maybe drama or something a bit more serious, more weighed down, can have a greater impact. You mentioned the Joker. I think that could be one that really does highlight that, you know, there is violence in there, but it's more about stories, about characters, and a case study for mental illness, something that can stand the test of time and not be as controversial.
Ramya, you picked a comedy. How do you think genre can influence the way a film becomes a classic?
My personal opinion is that any genre is going to have to go through this question, right? Like, how has it aged? What in this is not appropriate anymore? Or what is, like, history but not current times, language, you know, production, anything like that, really. So comedy is a good one to analyze, but I really think that all the genres go through it. And I think of it similar to books, right? You can enjoy a book, you can understand why it's a classic. If it's a classic, people will go read it and check it out, but it doesn't mean that it's something that would be written or adapted the same way today. So I don't know, I'm really more of a curious person, and I can be aware that this is not really great in, you know, 2030 but yeah. But still, it was for its time, yeah. Really funny.
Oh, I say this without judgment. One of the most problematic movies ever made is Wedding Crashers. If Wedding Crashers pops up on cable, I'm going to watch it because it's funny, mm-hmm. even though it's deeply, deeply, deeply inappropriate. Yeah. That's what makes it funny. Nazarene, how does genre influence the way a film may have staying power?
I think for it to be, so I agree with you in terms of comedy, where it's like back then you can make jokes that you really can't make today. And it also includes like some shows that I know that are considered classic, like Friends. There are some topics that they talk about, like the LGBTQ. They kind of make jokes about that you really can't make it today. So I think I would go towards more action where it's really memorable and comedy. So like Marvel movies, for example, it's more action, but also there's comedy thrown into it. And I think that's not just a trending type of genre. It's been there since time. So it makes it memorable.
Nazarene, Alex, thank you both for this. Ramya, before I say goodbye to you, you are the host of Kelly and Ramya, which comes our way at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV and AMI Audio. What's the top line item you want to preview for today's show?
I will shout out Mary Mammoliti of Kitchen Confession. She's talking about 5 most trusted techniques for maintaining a clean kitchen.
Oh, God.
And one of them is not don't go in your kitchen. That's not part of the list.
I could use some of that advice. I'll be sure to tune in at 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI TV and AMI Audio. My kitchen is filthy right now.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a dirty boy. Ramya, thank you for this.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Ramya Muthan, the co-host of Kelly and Ramya, which comes your way 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI TV and AMI Audio. Coming up next, Don Dickinson has a preview of Voices of the Walrus with an article about public domain, how Winnie the Pooh got turned into a slasher flick. Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI TV. A new episode of Voices of the Walrus will air this weekend on AMI Audio. It features an article about gender and trans identity in young people. Dawn Dickinson is here to share a preview. Hey, good morning, Dawn.
Hey there, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, Dawn, how present is this conversation around youth and trans identity?
Well, we're hearing about it all the time now. It's quite controversial. new data from the University of California has found that the number of young people in the United States who identify as trans has doubled in recent years, which might help explain why access to gender-affirming care for children and youth has become the center of an increasingly high-stakes public debate. Between 2021 and 2022, 34... This blew me away, this statistic, Dave. 34 U.S. states introduced bills banning this type of care with the same amount labeling treatment like puberty blockers and hormone therapy as child abuse.
That's,
wow.
Yeah, that's the American context on this. What's the situation in Canada?
While Canada may be much more progressive on the matter, I mean, obviously we are, finding healthcare providers who are both willing and competent to provide these services to youth is still a real struggle. In Ontario, any family doctor or nurse practitioner is legally allowed to refer patients for gender-affirming surgery. Wonderful. But in practice, it's very difficult. At Toronto Sick Kids Gender Youth Clinic, one of the only clinics in the province that specializes in gender-affirming care for children, wait times just to see a practitioner average 1 year.
Dawn, zooming out a little bit here, how do definitions of gender contribute to the conversation that's being had here, some of the back and forth and some of the barriers?
Yeah, well, basically, Dave, at the core, it boils down to the misunderstanding about the nature of gender itself. On the conservative side, we all know that gender is determined by what they say is biological sex. On the progressive side, they see it as a more internal thing, a feeling of strong identification with a gender, regardless of the actual physical assignment at birth. And while each side has its disagreements, there is, believe it or not, a common denominator which the two share, and that's permanence, or the idea that individuals have a single true gender identity. Parents and professionals alike worry about the perceived risk of making the wrong choice, that young people may eventually think that they were mistaken about their gender identities and come to rue the day that they altered their body with hormones and surgical treatments. So it's this idea that there is, in fact, you know, you're absolutely male or absolutely female, and that's the way it is. And we all know now through, you know, medical research and examples and whatnot, that gender is a very fluid thing.
That's just a snippet of that article. Certainly this is one that folks should tune into this weekend to have a closer listen to the in-depth reading for Voices of the Walrus. But Dawn, let's move on to something a little bit more absurd. From the serious to the absurd, Winnie the Pooh. Everybody remembers Winnie the Pooh from when they were a kid. It was a happy, fun kids book or kids TV show. Oh, I'm Winnie the Pooh. It's been adapted to be a little bit different here into a horror film called Blood and Honey. Dawn, what's the scoop on this movie?
Yeah, Dave, you know, it's hard to believe this is the case, but it turns out that filmmaker Reese Frake Waterfield's directorial debut is in fact Winnie the Pooh, but very much adjusted. It begins with Christopher Robin, no longer you know, a little boy in Mary Jane's, but a cardigan-wearing university graduate, and he has returned to the 100-acre wood to introduce his fiancée to his childhood friends. However, the friends have fared very poorly. Without him to take care of them, he's basically, you know, things have gone bad. they've turned what the article says, hungry and feral. Piglet is now tusked and fearsome, a full-sized boar. Eeyore has had his pessimistic worldview cruelly vindicated, and basically Pooh has lost interest in all his old pursuits.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, and these days he's turned killer. So the film is called Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, and basically it's a slasher film.
Dawn, how is this film being perceived as a win for creative freedom?
Okay, well, that's it is in a sense a win. The reason being that before this period in time, Winnie the Pooh was in fact an intellectual property by the English writer, as we all know, A.A. Milne, who invented the character after seeing a bear from Ontario in a London zoo. But 14 months ago, Milne's version of Pooh entered the U.S. public domain, and that's what's made the big difference. The expiration date of copyright is one of the most decisive all-or-nothing events that can take place. Suddenly, pretty much all of the Milne Pooh collection, the characters, the stories, the line drawings, and everything, basically are up for grabs.
Yeah,
because it's no longer copyright protected.
Yeah, the intellectual property is for anybody to play with as they please. That's one of the reasons why you can do almost anything you want with William Shakespeare's works, right? You can play with it and interpret it as you please. So, Dawn, just because it's into public domain doesn't mean people are overjoyed with this reinterpretation. What's been the opposite response from, say, the creative freedom lovers?
Well, other than every grandmother in the world, surprisingly, or unsurprisingly, I should say, the film has had its share of detractors. Alec Dent, cultural editor of The Dispatch, characterizes it as a monstrous reinterpretation and a transgression against innocence itself. itself. The fact that this is being done to Winnie the Pooh is completely saddening, he says. The fact that it's being done with the original stories is even worse. So you can imagine, I mean, it is kind of sacred when it comes down to it, Winnie the Pooh. You know, and of course, we all have a great affinity for it because of the bear and whatnot. Yeah. It's a lot of people don't appreciate it. You know?
I'm giggling because this is absurdist and it's fun, and that really fits into my worldview of like a world that can be wacky. But I do acknowledge, right, that sometimes these things can be sacred, although nothing is truly sacred in this interpretive world. But Don, I'm telling you, I'm just waiting for a modern interpretation of Garfield, the high-end lasagna thief. Like, now we're really getting somewhere.
Yeah. Vicious Garfield eats more than lasagna. Yeah, exactly.
Garfield grows up and becomes a vicious tiger escaping from the zoo, or Free Willy taking his revenge against SeaWorld. I'm telling you, there's all this content we can make. But for now, Dawn, we have to say goodbye. You are an excellent content curator on the reading shows. Have a lovely weekend.
Okay, Dave, take care.
That's Dawn Dickinson, the content curator for Voices of the Walrus. You can find that show weekends at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. You can find this show tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV. Until then, I'm Dave Brown reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun. Hey, Dave Brown here. If you enjoy this podcast portion of our show, remember you can watch it live every day at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI TV.
Hi, I'm Red Sail, inviting you to download the latest episode of My Life in Books, where internationally acclaimed authors discuss their lives, their work, and three books that have resonated with them. That's My Life in Books, available wherever you get your AMI podcasts.